I'm Simon Lambert, and you're listening to one of the special bonus interview episodes of the This Is Money podcast that we like to bring you from time to time. On this episode, I speak to Nick Hounsfield, founder of The Wave, which is one of only a handful of world-class artificial surfing lakes, and it calls the village of Easter Compton, just outside Bristol, home. I recently took a trip down to The Wave to meet Nick, get shown around, and get him to tell us about the more than decade-long journey to creating one of the first public facilities of this kind in the whole world using cutting-edge technology. He explained how he went from a dream built on his passion for surfing and desire to make a positive impact on health and well-being to the reality of perfect waves breaking in the English countryside. It's a fascinating story, not least because Nick didn't come from a background in property or business, but was an osteopath who started with £500 in his bank account and managed to raise £27 million to build his dream. In our conversation, it's also clear how for Nick, this was never just about a business, but about trying to create something that would have a positive impact, and somehow balancing that with the need to be profitable. But enough from me. Nick tells his own story much better than I can. And yes, after this conversation, I did have a surf. If you want to know more about that, make sure you listen to the end of the podcast. I'm in southwest England. Outside the window, there are perfect waves peeling into a bay. There's Friday morning surfers riding them. But I'm not in North Devon, not even in Cornwall. I'm in a field just outside Bristol. And those waves are being created in an artificial lake called The Wave. And I'm sitting here talking to Nick Hounsfield, founder and chief vision officer of The Wave. Nick, welcome to the This Is Money podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell us, in your own words, how would you describe The Wave?
I would describe it as taking a huge slice of the ocean, an active piece of the ocean with waves crashing down, and dropping it right in the middle of some beautiful countryside on the outskirts of Bristol. Around that is also a great clubhouse, place people can hang out, be outside, be in nature. Have good food, good coffee, good vibes, good people around, and a sort of real positive experience.
And is this the kind of place that's just for experienced surfers, or is it for beginners, or is it for everyone, really?
Yeah, 100% for everyone. So right back at the beginning, I always said that this is for people of all ages, all backgrounds, all abilities. So this isn't something that is super niche for people who are right at the top of their sporting ability. We actually have way more people coming here for the very first time, never been surfing before, never ridden a wave before, never, for some people, never been in the water before. And so it's just about making sure that they're getting into a safe space with good people, good, you know, lifeguards and coaches, and then being able to progress to the level that they want to get to. A lot of people just love just being here, just splashing about around waves, and have no, you know, need to go any higher than that. But like today, we've got some of the national teams here using it as a training ground for, you know, Olympic hopefuls. So yeah, everything in between.
When people think of surfing, they obviously think of the beach. It goes without saying. That's where you go to surf. But there is this technology that you use, which creates these wave pools in artificial lakes.
Yeah.
And my understanding is there's a couple of different types of the technology, but there aren't that many places like this actually in the world. I mean, how unique is The Wave?
Well, the particular sort of our slice of the ocean, there's this particular technology. There's only five in the world at the moment. We were the first ones in 2019 when we built it. So we were the first people to implement this brand new technology. And then there are other wave parks, wave pools around the world. There's probably around about 20, I think, that you could go and visit and sort of pay and have a session there. But it's right at the start of a nascent industry. I mean, this is really probably five years. It's been starting to grow as a proper business, but there's a real barrier to entry to this because it's really high capital cost to get it going. You've got to go through planning, you've got to go through all of the sort of permits, particularly abroad. There's some big permits like the USA. It's really hard to get planning for these kind of things. So, and you know, it took me nearly 10 years to do. So that's a real barrier to entry. But I think that the more and more these come through, the more and more people realize that there's a, you know, a great industry that's about to boom. Then we know that there's over 100 in plans, but it just takes time to bring those plans to fruition, which we very much know.
And is there another one in the UK?
So there's one. There's plans for one in Scotland, in Edinburgh. There are a few muted in Manchester, Birmingham. But we're very much at the forefront of things, particularly around London. So we've got a couple of sites that we're looking at in London to be able to bring forwards. So I think eventually I could see a future maybe 10, 15 years down the line that a lot of the really big conurbated cities will have them. I would imagine probably 7 to 10 around the UK. That's the vision, I think.
So obviously this technology is quite new.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't that many places.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most famous mm-hmm. that I'm aware of
yep.
is Kelly Slater,
yep.
the considered one of the greatest surfers of all time.
Yep.
He has one in the desert, isn't he?
Yeah,
he
does.
In the US.
Yeah.
I can see how he got one.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get here? Do you have a background in business or property and also a passion for surfing and decided to do this? Or
no, not at all. So my backstory is actually I'm from a healthcare background. So I was an osteopath for about 18 years, ran a really nice, decent practice in Bristol with my wife and a whole load of my other family members. They're all osteopaths. Was super happy, didn't need to change anything in particular. And then I made a promise to my dad on his deathbed that I would do something that would impact people's health and well-being on a much bigger scale. I was quite frustrated the fact that I was seeing the same kind of people coming in through the doors with the same kind of sort of ill health or stresses, either physical or mental stress. And I was like, there's got to be a better solution than this. And I was always just seeing the same kind of people, you know, middle-class white people, and not there's anything wrong with them, but it just wasn't right. I didn't feel like I was making the kind of impact that I could be doing from a health perspective. So off the back of that sort of crazy promise to my dad, I started to think around how we could create a space, like, do we build a hospital where we could get more people in? Or I was like, no, it's, you know, I could see that the real disconnect was in people's health, was disconnecting from each other, having a lack of connectivity with other people, but also the disconnect with the planet and people looking after their own health, and how that's really clearly linked to people's connection to the natural world. And started to go, oh, actually, this feels like it's much more of a place, a destination that people can come to. And if it's around water, maybe it's a lake, maybe it's swimming, and like start to fuse together sort of the natural environment to something that gets people active and having good conversations and good food and all those kind of things. I felt like we could do something there. And I was quite inspired by the Eden Project, about how they built something pretty bonkers, but were able to do some amazing messaging around, you know, the natural world and health and planetary health and real future facing work. And I was like, oh, so I picked up the phone to Sir Tim Smith, who was the founder of the Eden Project, and it's like, oh, I've got an idea. And he said, yeah, that's a really cool idea. And then as luck would have it, I've been surfing for 45 years, and I was on YouTube one day, and they announced this new technology was announced on that day. And I looked at it, and then suddenly it's like, oh my goodness, like making waves inland. Like if that could be the centerpiece of everything that goes around that sort of health and well-being agenda, That could fly. And so that was the start of it, really. But I had, you know, literally had 500 quid No real business background, but what I did have was a very, very clear vision and purpose about what we wanted to build and why we were going to do it. And I guess probably my main strength is about bringing people's hearts and minds along a journey with me. So then was able to build a team around me that, like, oh, this is too cool not to get involved. And then we sort of announced it very publicly. And then, you know, basically started to build a community of people that just wanted to make it happen. So business leaders, lawyers, architects, just going, look, I'm going to work with you pro bono to just get this done because it's so cool. We just want to be attached to it and work with you. And so that's sort of really built that momentum to be able to get to the point where, you know, eventually we had to raise £27 million, which was no mean task. Get planning permission on a green belt piece of land, which is challenging. But yeah, we just sort of, with optimism and passion, we you know, stepped through every hurdle that we came against.
And I mean, for someone thinking about this and thinking, right, well, I've got an idea,
yeah,
and I would like to put it into practice,
yeah,
but my idea doesn't cost £27 million, yeah, and involve building somewhere that people can go and surf,
yeah,
you know, in the middle of the countryside, creating mm-hmm. these perfect waves using a brand new technology. There's only, you know, 10 to 20 of these in the world,
yeah,
and I can't work out how to get my idea off the ground, mm-hmm. you know, so this guy who's managed to do this, you know, wow, but I could never do that. What were the first steps that you took from your, I've got this idea, this does seem slightly bonkers, and I've only got £500,
mm-hmm.
but I would need to get the ball rolling.
Yeah, get that momentum going. Yeah.
Did you team up with someone? Was it finding a partner or just...
No, it was mainly, I mean, it's built, I mean, teaming up to start off with friends, family, you know, probably the biggest sort of stakeholder in all of this is my wife, because we basically had to go, I have to stop work. She has to continue to work to, you know, keep the house going, and got three kids and all the rest of it. So, you know, having somebody that every single day goes, you can do this. You know, I've got faith that you'll be able to achieve this. Then surrounding myself with amazing people who again are going, yeah, it is bonkers, but you know, why not? You should give it a go. And then that, and by the way, I've got a friend, you know, who could help with architects or what have you. And so you just start building a community of people that really believe in why you're wanting to get this achieved. So I guess you then constantly getting validation of the idea, and yeah, everybody's saying, yeah, it's bonkers, it's bonkers, it's bonkers, but everyone's saying, but if you can pull it off, it would be amazing. And I guess it's just that constant validation that the idea is a good idea. If it's achievable, then you absolutely should do it. And then growing that audience, really. So even down to when we sort of launched a crowdfunder campaign, and then suddenly have people going, we'll invest in this process. We want to be a part of it. And then suddenly you've got, you know, £250,000 worth of money invested in from the crowd. And of course, then you go to the big investors and go, well, we've raised this off vapor, pretty much. It's just some CGIs and a real will to do it. And you know, that absolutely builds that momentum. We're going, well, there's something in here. It's like, if these guys can raise that kind of money through a community and an audience of people who really believe it, I think there's something in here. So it's just, yeah, it's slowly, steadily building that momentum, really.
And when you were going through that funding process and you were getting obviously towards the back end of it, where you're actually having to raise millions of pounds mm. to get something that is very capital intensive
yeah.
built, how careful did you have to be there in terms of finding the right people
mm-hmm.
to back you? Because, I mean, from what you've said, it sounds, well, from what you've said, this isn't just about building a business, a place where people can go surfing, they can pay to go surfing, you can make lots of money. It's about having an impact, a social impact.
Yeah.
So that means you've got to be quite careful about who you're getting to fund you and who you're partnering with, presumably.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So it's that, you know, we talk about which that profits with purpose piece really is, like, we absolutely have to be unashamedly profit making because we're borrowing crazy amounts of money from people and we need to repay them. But actually, I think generally across the finance industry, it seems that people are understanding ESG, like the how important it is to be future facing, but future facing obviously from a profit perspective, but also looking after people and looking after planet at the same time, and how important that actually is in terms of building a brand, building a business that actually brings more value. So your values then create value to the entity that you're delivering. And so what we did right at the beginning was very, very much set out our stall in terms of we are going to be environmentally conscious, making sure we're also looking, you know, socially conscious as well, but absolutely be profit making. And I mean, it wasn't easy. Myself and Craig Stoddart, who's CEO, we had to see, I don't know, 230, 250 investors over the course of 18 months. And everyone said, yeah, again, what an amazing idea. We definitely are really interested, but we'll back the second one, not the first one. Classic example, you know, classic, the number of times we were told that. So everyone thought it was a great idea, but nobody was prepared to take the risk on it. Until we came across an amazing guy, another Nick, and he was wanting to build one in London. And just didn't have the sort of know-how. You know, we'd obviously been by that stage going through the process for about 6 years, but he had access to capital. And so we teamed up together and said, look, let's do it together. We'll do one here. And this is the vision. This is the purpose that will also be behind the profits. And then we'll do one in London and snowball it from there. And that's exactly what's happened. So yeah, we had to sort of kiss a lot of frogs to find the right prince. But fundamentally, you know, they did need to understand that this is also around that purpose bit as well as the profits. Mm-hmm. But I think that they work hand in hand, and actually it is it's good business. You know, being a good business, and I truly believe that, and you know, that's why we're still here right now, going through some pretty tricky times, but actually having a clear purpose as to why, you know, this isn't something that will at the first chance we could just mothball it or flip it over because it's just a business. No, it's got a higher purpose, and people want this to succeed, from the people who work here every single day. To our investors, they're like, this is more than just a business that we just sell surfing. It's got a higher purpose, really.
And when did the idea start? How long was it in the making? So
it's 12 years, pretty much to the day. It took what took 10 years to build, and yeah, went back 13 years to the day. So yeah, so we opened 2019. Yeah.
Yeah. So I first heard your story in late 2019. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that sounds amazing. I can surf badly on and off since I was a teenager. But I was like, that sounds great. You know, sounds a bit like the snow dome idea. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, you could go do this, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can surf in this country in a way that you can't really snowboard in this country.
Yeah, true.
But it's the reliability of it, the ability to turn up and go do it. I thought that sounds like a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
And then something happened, didn't it?
Yeah.
COVID hit.
Yeah.
Had you managed to open before COVID hit?
Yeah. So we opened October 2019. So we did. We decided to open as quickly as possible. One, because we borrowed loads of money. We needed to just start showing that we can produce some revenue, but also we thought it'd be wise for us to do it over the winter so that we could really sort of make sure that operationally we're really tight before we do a heavy sort of big summer, spring, summer season. So that sort of first 4 or 5 months was hardcore. It was cold. It was, you know, we were running around like headless chickens at times, just trying to work out how this place works because it's never been done before.
That was a really horrible winter, wasn't it?
It was really wet and cold. Absolutely. So yeah, we sort of but we pulled together, managed to make it work to then go, okay, I think we're set up for spring, summer. And then and then COVID hit. Nobody would have expected it, would they? So
and I mean, you were then, when did you manage to reopen?
So we sort of did that sort of weird staggering opening and closing later on that year. So I think they sort of allowed people to get outside and do outdoor activity, organize outdoor activity, but there were some real restrictions around using internal space. So it's kind of weird for us because we're a real hybrid. It's got a beautiful outdoor space, which is like very sort of socially distant, sort of friendly, so to speak. But then we've got an indoor space, which, you know, people coming here, they get hungry, they want food, all the rest of it. So then we've got the restrictions that pubs and restaurants had whilst having this incredible outdoor space. So yeah, it was really interesting time for us in terms of trying to work out how we could operate, stay open, like absolutely be safe, adhere to the guidelines, but equally having to pivot like almost every week going, all right, guidelines are changed now. We got to reconfigure the whole internal space of our clubhouse so that we can flex and make sure that we can provide a great experience. So yeah, it was massive learnings, but actually, you know, reflecting back, it was a good experiment to be able to try. It's not ideal because it was enforced on us, but actually allows us to go, actually, what is the perfect flow of this space, which we would never have been able to do without COVID, because we probably wouldn't have had the chance to try four or five different styles of doing things,
and then really sit back and think, okay, how do we make this work?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And personally, over that period of time, you also had a serious challenge on mm-hmm. your way. You had a stroke, I understand.
Yeah, I had a big stroke in February on that year. Yeah, COVID year.
Yeah.
Which was, again, nobody would have foresaw that. That was, totally out of the blue. So, yeah.
And did you end up in hospital or in recovery for a long time?
Yeah, so I went, so it happened whilst I was playing hockey and just suddenly felt really, really weird. Started to lose a bit of grip strength on the hockey stick, suddenly couldn't follow the ball. Felt really, I can't even describe it. Felt very strange. And I just sort of went to the dugout and just sat down. I was like, something really weird's going on. And then people started to ask me what's wrong. And I just suddenly realized I couldn't speak. And then I heard just behind me somebody say, oh my God, I think he's having a stroke. The sort of fear of God went through me. I was like, that's exactly what I know I'm having a stroke now. I had to go to hospital, which was a little bit of a disaster. I ended up then having about 8 strokes. And then it was in hospital for a number of weeks, but because COVID was just starting to properly get rampant, they wanted us to get out of the hospital as quick as possible and do the rehab at home. So I was there for a couple of weeks, and then it was pretty much 6 to 9 months of rehabilitating at home. Yeah.
Did you have to step back from the business for that whole period?
Yeah, try to. It's quite hard to. Because of course we're very out there as a business, and you know, on Facebook, social media, all that sort of stuff. So as much as I could try and protect myself from getting involved, I absolutely wanted to know what was going on. Are our staff going to be okay? All the rest of it. And some big, you know, chunky decisions that needed to be made about the business at that time, without any ability to influence it. So it was really quite a strange time. But you know, great people around me, lots of the non-execs sort of stepped up and really helped through that time, and hopefully then, you know, made the right decisions, which absolutely saved the business. So which is why we're able to sort of fight for another day.
I mean, beyond the obviously personally devastating impact of something like that on your health, the fact that you had spent so long trying to get this off the ground and you'd finally got it open, then COVID had hit and then that had happened. That must have been, that must have felt like quite dark times for you in that sense.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there was definitely times in that rehab, it's like, I need to stop. I need to properly stop, like get some perspective about life, family particularly. Hadn't been I'm not a bad father, but I hadn't been as you know, there for the kids as it as I could have done, which I'm sure most founders of any businesses will probably attest to. So it just is really good sort of perspective check, really, about what is important, and also to the business. It's like, well, we've got it built, so I've got an amazing team. Do I need to go back? But actually there was too much to do. I felt like it was still chapter one of a much bigger book. And opening it is just the first bit of it. And the second bit is how we can actually deliver the true vision of what we wanted this place to be. So taking it from being a surf lake where you can come and pay for a session to go surfing and go away, to something that actually much more community focused, like building, like a really building a great culture, both internally and externally, and then create an amazing blueprint that we can then go and do in other places. Because actually it was always about impact. How can we impact people's health and well-being through the power of what we call blue health, being in water, being around water, and how great that is for people's health and well-being. And I just saw that the scale of what we could still achieve is just too big to stop. So I've got to be careful not to get too stressed and things like that. But fundamentally, it's around, there's too much to do still. I still felt like it was right at the beginning of the journey. So I needed to get back to work.
And the impact there that you said you wanted to have, and the impact from your original dream, was you wanted to do something that helped people's health and well-being, their physical health, their mental health. How did it help you when you came back here?
Yeah.
Got back into the wave.
Yeah.
Started working, seeing presumably the guests who were coming here.
Yeah. Yep.
And what they were doing, how they were feeling.
Yeah.
And getting in the water yourself.
Yeah. Well, it's, I was pretty lucky when I was able to drive again. I did come down here. The whole place was shut, of course, but you know, trees needed to be watered, the lake needed to be cleaned and kept good. So actually it became weirdly my own medicine chest, this place. I started to get in the water every single day, cleaning, just tending to the place. And I noticed that, because I didn't need, there was nobody around, so I didn't have to talk to anyone. So I was just literally, you know, just me in nature with water. And I felt like every single day that I was doing that, I was getting better. So I just kept doing it. And then eventually, once lockdown was starting to sort of ease a bit, I was like, we need to share this. And it was the perfect storm then for us, because everybody had been locked up, as I'm sure you have seen, everybody was able to talk for the first time about mental health and the fact that they've not been connected to people, not been connected to nature, and how that was impacting their health and well-being. And of course, we had a great medicine chest for that. Like, come here, surround yourselves with great people, smiling faces, be in nature, do something active that's fun. And I think that set us up really great for when we came out of lockdown and we got super busy, because people then go, that's exactly, I don't need to buy any more stuff. I actually need an experience. I need to have a connection, with my own health, but also, with people. And this is a great place to be able to do that.
How's it felt seeing those people coming here surfing, seeing the smiles on their faces when they come out of the water at the end of a session?
Yeah, it's amazing. And you know, it's our lifeblood as a team. It's the thing that we can every single day, hand on our hearts, know that we've properly impacted people's lives through what we're doing every single day. And you know, the feedback is amazing as well. And it's probably every single day I get messages on sort of Twitter or Instagram going, oh my goodness, thank you so much for having built this place. You know, it's you know, for some people, it's literally they saying it saved their lives or saved their marriage, or it's saved them from downward spiraling. So, which is great, because it's, you know, right back at the beginning, you'd go, oh, you know, people would be going, oh, thank you for doing this because I've had an amazing surf and I've improved my surfing and stuff. Don't get that. We have people commenting about actually how this has improved their health and well-being. And of course, they'll improve surfing as well. And that's great. And, you know, it's always great to progress on something and it gives you confidence and stuff. But all the messages that I get is around how this has affected people's health and well-being, which is kind of cool, because that was obviously always the vision. And if we can get that balance of something cool that is progressing a sport, but at the same time is a real panacea for some of the ills that we see in society and NHS gets absolutely slammed for, actually we could be part of a solution, which would be, yeah, fantastic.
And how important was it to you from the sort of perspective of your vision, but also from the perspective of this needs to be a successful business, that you could pitch it at different levels of ability? Because it goes all the way from people who set in foot on a surfboard for the first time to very advanced, isn't it?
Yeah.
How does that work?
In terms of?
Well, how does it work in terms of, tell us a bit about how it works for those different abilities.
Yep.
I mean, how does the wave change for a start?
Yep.
How does the technology work and change?
Yep.
And also, why was it important to be able to not just go, right, I just want to build somewhere for really good surfers to
I mean, it's a good question. And the brutal answer is that there aren't enough surfers. If you to go down that's a real super elite model, which like Kelly Slater's wave pool is pretty much very, you know, it's an amazing place. I've been there, it's just incredible, but it's very super advanced. There aren't enough surfers to be able to maintain that as a business. So, well, or you're going to have to really charge through the nose. You know, it'll be, I can't remember the latest numbers, but, you know, to hire out one of those places is, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds to be able to do. So we don't yet have a big enough cohort of surfers to be able to just purely do an elite wave. And the other bit is, I've also got sort of another hat is chairman of Surfing England. And it's about, for us, it's also about growing the sport to find out, you know, the untapped talent that's there. So the only way you can do that is to build, you know, get more people, so to speak, through the pipeline, and to go, okay, you know, who's there that could really progress and be amazing for the sport and be inspirational for the sport, particularly now surfing is in the Olympics, is that there's a real pathway there to go, actually, the more people we can get in you know, at the grassroots and to develop, then actually that could be our future aspirational surfers. And that also helps with funding for the sport, because if you've got a real pipeline of opportunities, progression from tiny kids right the way up to the top, then you can start to build a sport around it, which is great. So it works on so many levels, as a business level, as a growth of sport level, and then sort of going back to the sort of more health and well-being side of it, is that it's something that I think everyone should have access to. Obviously, at the moment, it's quite tricky because, you know, it's definitely a financial barrier for people to come here. But we're working now with amazing partners who are helping to fund people coming here, groups to come here, people breaking down sort of cultural barriers, financial barriers for people to come here, so that we can actually get a much more diverse audience of surfers coming here, or even not surfing, just coming here to experience how great it is to be around water, waves, and the sort of positive vibe that you get around this place. So that goes back to the mantra right at the beginning of all ages, all backgrounds, all abilities. It's right to do it that way as on a human level, but secondly, it makes great business sense because then you open the whole market up. It means anybody could give it a try and come here rather than being super niche elite sport. So on both levels, from a purpose level, it's really important, and from profits level, it's really important.
And I guess surfing it is a sport, I think, like some of the other board sports, you know, like snowboarding or like skiing as well. It's seen as a white middle class sport, mm-hmm. isn't mm-hmm. it? Mm-hmm. And I mean, the thing with skiing or snowboarding is you've got to pay for a lift ticket,
yep.
and that is expensive.
Yeah,
but the beach is free.
Yep,
the waves are free. Yep. Obviously, it costs money to come here, but people can come here. They can learn. They can practice. Mm-hmm. And then they can go to the beach, and it's not really going to cost them that much money,
yeah.
you know, necessarily to go to the beach.
Yeah.
They don't have to stay there.
Yeah.
How important is it to you to manage to get those people in who wouldn't be from the demographic who would ever think about surfing in the first place, but
yep.
could probably really benefit from the sort of the community and the framework and the social mm-hmm. aspect and the purpose around
yeah.
it?
I mean, it's vitally important. That's our number one priority, really. Again, from a business point of view, if you can widen that demographic and the diversity of that audience, then it makes great business sense. But fundamentally, it's why we started this in the first place, is be able to reach out to those communities who just don't have access to something like this. And you know, and even down at the beach, you know, we know that there's only good waves about 30% of the time. So even if you get down there, it might not be particularly great. And now the fuel cost to get down there is probably, you know, like it's going to be cheaper to come here than it is to get in the car and go down there. And not everybody's got car, so you know, being able to get here, you know, that's one of the things that we need to be working on quite a lot now, is about that social mobility, getting people here able to come here through public transport and making sure that there's sustainable transport to be able to get here. Because again, we're a little bit constrained that people still have to get into a car to come here. So that's something that's a barrier that we need to start sort of looking at how we can manage that and improve it. But yeah, fundamentally, it just makes perfect sense on, as I say, from a purpose and profit perspective, to make sure that we're diversifying that audience as wide as possible.
And it's not just COVID that's obviously been thrown in your path. You've now been open, you know, for a while since then, and then you've been chucked the problem of energy prices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that this is somewhere that has a fairly large energy bill.
Yeah.
How much of a challenge has that been, and what are you doing about that?
So it's a big challenge. So, you know, our main costs are people, you know, our wave makers and power. I mean, it's without a doubt the most energy efficient system that's out there. However, it still sucks a huge amount of energy. So we had a very, very clear red line from day one, is that we will never, ever take fossil fuel power. It just makes no sense to be doing something ultimately outdoors, nature-based, and building something like this if it's to the demise of the real oceans and the climate. So absolute red line is that all of our energy has to come from the renewable grid. And then about 2 years ago, we started down the line of, can we actually take it off grid? Can we actually, you know, generate our own solar array with battery storage? So thankfully, particularly with the current energy prices, by May next year we'll be completely off grid, and in fact we'll be contributing to the grid at times. So all of our waves will be solar powered by next year, which again is the right thing to do as a business, as a purpose. Absolutely, it hits the bottom line as well in terms of us not having to then, that's a big energy bill that we're wiping out, which is fantastic.
That's impressive that you could manage to generate enough electricity to run a machinery like that.
Yeah,
solar panels.
Yeah it's about I think it's about 1.5 acres of solar with the battery storage, so it's it doesn't take huge amount of space considering the sort of energy draw that we get from, you know, to make the waves.
How does the technology work to create the waves?
So it's basically a succession of paddles. So it's very, very mechanical, mechanics based. It's a series of paddles that creates the waves. There's a bit of trickery in there, which has obviously got some IP, but basically it's just moving paddles in sequence that creates a perfect wave. And then actually the real technology is around the bathymetry, the lake bed. That's the proper trickery or science really around it. The reason why this has never been done earlier is because you needed to have supercomputers to be able to do all the hydrodynamics and the bathymetry of the lake bed. And you'd have to rent supercomputers from big universities. It's really expensive to do. But nowadays, with the advancement of technology and computer technology, is that they can do all that computer fluid dynamic modeling, overnight on just a laptop. And that allowed them to really advance. Like right now, we can create the perfect wave. Was before you could make waves, you could push waves, but they weren't very decent quality. Whereas it's that those supercomputers and that technology that's allowed that to advance.
And you can create different types of wave, can't you?
Yeah, we've got, I think the settings are like over 1,000 settings that we could create, but trying to sell, it's already pretty complicated to sort of go onto the website and try to explain people who've never been here before. It's like, right, these are the different settings and this is what you should be doing. So we just try to keep it as simple as possible. So there's something there for absolute beginners. We've even got like a play in the bay experience for young kids. They can just grab a bodyboard and just muck around in water, right up to the sort of the best barrels for international athletes to come and train on.
And what would be your tip to someone coming down here and booking themselves a wave? Do you get that classic thing where everybody goes for, oh yeah, thinks they're better than they are and goes for one up?
Yeah, it's interesting. So right back at the beginning, it's really interesting. Men mainly thought that they're better than they are. And
I can't believe that.
Yeah, I know. And women generally thought that they're worse than they are, which was really, really interesting in terms of looking at that from a societal level even. So what we did end up was that first 3 or 4 months is that people were thinking they're better than they were. And, that definitely created confusion. It's a good level of being out there is if you think you're good and better than you are, then you will absolutely know it after 10-15 minutes. So I would always say just enter into it steadily and ideally get lessons without a doubt. There's some quirks around this particular wave. It's good to know much more through having a coach with you. And then most importantly, just keep an open mind and smile on your face. That's the most important thing. We always say best surfer out there is the one that's having the most fun, which is true. It's totally true.
And what's next? I mean, for you.
Yep.
and also for the business.
Yeah. Well, I think, for the business, we've got ambitions. We want to roll this out to different areas. So we're very committed to doing projects in London and various others. But London is a real focus for us because it is a great place to be able to deliver one. And then I guess the reality as well of the next year could be quite tricky from a global economy perspective. So it's around making sure that I think around pricing, making sure that people have got still access to something where maybe they it goes into the would nice to do, but I'll do it when I've got money, to actually it's much more essential for people's health and well-being. So I think that's really big part of the messaging going, actually, we're going to have probably quite a tricky year going ahead. But actually, this is much more in the essential thing for your health and well-being rather than a novelty thing that you'll do when you've got disposable income again. And I do know, for a fact that that's the way a lot of people are thinking of using this place already. And so it's just about making sure that we're supporting people who are going to come to this place. And for some people, that might be around price, but it might also be around other things, creating a community much more. So being able to have music nights, film nights, inspirational talks coming here, and create much more of a community when at times, I guess, particularly with what's going on in the world at the moment, I think it's a real important time for people to join together and have that sort of sense of community around the wave. So that's what our focus is going to be this year, is building the community, but also keeping alive the prospect of us being able to do London and various other projects. Yeah.
Nick, thank you very much.
Of course, thank you very much.
That was Nick Hounsfield, who I have to say a big thank you to for welcoming me to The Wave and telling us his story. I'm sure you'll agree it's a fascinating one, and it's also a journey that's far from over. I wish him the best of luck with the next chapters of it. And not least because one of those next chapters is going to be north of London and a lot closer to my home. Speaking of which, so what was it like to surf The Wave? Firstly, I suppose I should explain that you don't need to take anything with you. If you don't have a surfboard, if you don't have a wetsuit, they've got everything there that you need. Boards, wetsuits, and so on. But if you do have your own kit, you can take it with you. The setup is that the artificial lake is a large concrete lake, and then there is a pier that runs up the middle, which is where the machinery is underneath. That creates two sides to surf, the left and the right. If you imagine the shape of it, it's like a bay or a cove. And so it's got a wide shoreline narrowing as you go up the lake. At the narrow end is where the waves break. And the front end of the bay is the wider beginner area. And then behind that, you have the waves for the more intermediate and advanced surfers. You paddle out, which is actually nicely and easy because there's a current that helps take you up the side of the pier into a lineup that then turns into more of a line where the waves break. There's a marker on the wall. You line yourself up with the marker. You start to paddle. You catch the wave. It's that simple. And actually, it is a relatively easy wave to catch. As anybody who's ever surfed in the ocean will know, catching waves, and in fact, getting out to the waves in the first place, is one of the hardest things that you can do. Then you've got to sit there in a lineup of lots of other surfers trying to work out, is it my turn? Am I the closest to the peak? Am I operating the right surfer etiquette? There's none of that complicated stuff to do in the water at the wave. And in fact, actually, one of the things that Nick says is that he wants to help people understand more about that world of surfing that can feel quite intimidating to some people when they first get into the ocean. It's a proper wave. The intermediate wave that I surfed, it's a green-faced wave. It's not white water. But whilst it's relatively easy to catch, it was harder to ride than I thought. It's a really good wave, but coming off a week in France at the beach, riding messy, powerful Atlantic beach break waves, I thought I would find it easier than I did. It's fast and it's got quite a bit of power. I was getting up on the waves, but was I riding them in as well as I wanted to? Absolutely not. I did the intermediate session. There's sessions above that go up to the advanced level, and there's sessions below that all the way down to beginner. The wave before the intermediate wave is one that they call the Waikiki wave, which is a slightly easier wave to ride. And with hindsight, I think I should have tried at least one session on that. The good thing is that you get more waves in an hour in the wave pool than you're going to get in a much longer time in the ocean. One thing I did write was that I did a lesson in the morning, which is a slightly longer session than you get for a normal surf. A normal surf session is about an hour. The lesson is an hour and a half. And that's really good because they've got a really good team of instructors there who not only are giving you tips on what to do, and they're in the water with you, helping you out, saying you should in a group, saying you should maybe try this, try that. But also they talk you through the whole process and of catching the wave to begin with, which I must admit, when you first get in there, does feel a bit strange if you're more used to being in the sea. I also did a session later on in the afternoon for an hour just by myself. And I recommend that if you are going to go visit the wave, especially if you got to travel quite a distance like I did, that maybe you should spend a day or half a day there and try to do two sessions, but give yourself plenty of time to rest in between, because surfing is tiring and even in an artificial lake, surfing is tiring. There's also plenty to do at the Wave, and more than enough to pass the time while you hang out there, even on a chilly, cold, rainy day that I was there. I imagine in glorious sunshine, it'd be fantastic. It's definitely somewhere that I'll be heading back to. And I would say anybody who's interested in surfing, whether you're a total beginner who's never had a go, whether you're painfully average like me, or you're more advanced, get down there. It's definitely worth a visit. It is a unique facility. It's not quite a unique facility. There are a few of them around in the world, but there isn't another one like that in the UK. And it's really impressive. Anyway, I'll be back with Georgie and the usual This Is Money podcast next time around. If you like this episode, please share it. And also come and give the This Is Money podcast a rating and leave us a review wherever you usually listen, as it helps us spread the word.